Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, this is how it all began.
This is the Australian Broadcasting Commission, relaying throughout Australia the opening night of the newly constituted Australian Broadcasting Commission.
Yep, that's how it all began for the ABC, way back on the 1st of July in 1932 with Conrad Charlton announcing the beginning of our national broadcaster. The ABC is preparing to celebrate its 90th birthday next year. I know, we thought we might take a trip down memory lane to learn about some of the ABC's history in this first hour. We've only got 50 minutes or so. It's not a definitive history of Australia's public broadcast, but I tell you what, there are some terrific moments anyway. To take you through some of the highlights from the past 89 years, we're joined tonight by media historian Professor Bridget Griffin-Foley from Macquarie University. Bridget was the founding director of the university's Centre for Media History and has written many books about the Australian media, including A Companion to Australian Media. Bridget, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, Phil. Always good to be with you and on ABC Radio.
Yes, well, great to have you with us too. Also joining us tonight, Professor Laurie Zion. Now, Laurie's a former producer and presenter at Triple J. These days, he's the Associate Provost at La Trobe University in Research and Industry Engagement. But more importantly, from our point of view, he's the fellow who invented the Hottest 100. Laurie, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Phil. How are you going?
Some people achieve a lot in life, but you can say, I don't care what anyone else did. The Hottest 100 is mine. Well, we'll also be joined, too, by one of the ABC's much-loved sports broadcasters, Charlie King, a bit later on as well. Bridget, the ABC turns 90 next year. It seems incredible to me. Take us back to where it all began. Why was it established in the first place?
Broadcast technology was established in 1923 in Australia. By this stage, the BBC had begun in Britain, but there was a debate that went on throughout the 1920s about what the most appropriate system would be for Australian broadcasting, whether it should be purely the hands of the government or the public, as was the case with the BBC, which had a monopoly in Britain, or whether it should be commercial. So there are a number of musical and electronic retailers in the 1920s who began to form radio stations.
That's right, because we're talking about radio at the start. And radio is quite homegrown, isn't it? I mean, people are really building their own radio sets and making their own broadcasts. It's all a bit experimental, isn't it?
That's right. There's a great deal of experimentation that takes place, you know, even in the 1910s, where amateur experimenters are sort of working out how to do one-to-one broadcasting, how to convey messages over wireless or wireless as the more sort of evocative pronunciation. The debate then becomes, though, about how can you actually use that capacity to broadcast to a wider audience, to broadcast to a broad audience. And so there are a range of inquiries. There's a Royal Commission in the 1920s. There's various experiments. There's something that's called the sealed set system, which I won't bore you with. There's a sort of two-tier level of broadcasting that emerges in the 1920s with what are called A and B class stations. So the A class are run by a company called the Australian Broadcasting Company, and the B class are what become commercial broadcasters.
Yeah.
So then in 1932, finally, a decision is made by the government and the Postmaster General's Department to roll the A class stations into this new body, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, and also to have a continuation of B class stations, which become known as commercial stations.
That's right. So that's right. Now, so exactly, we didn't have just the government broadcaster, which the in a sense the BBC was. We from the earliest time had a commercial radio service as well as as well as a government service. So for the first 14 years or so, the ABC was just a radio service, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was. And, I mean, that's the case actually up until 1956, when the ABC starts in 1932. It and the commercial stations are the only form of sort of broadcast or electronic entertainment in Australia, other than movies, I should of course acknowledge. But they come into a media landscape that's dominated by newspapers and magazines. So just as there's a debate in the 1920s about sort of how to penetrate this land of magnificent distances, as sort of wireless periodicals would use terms like that, thinking about how could a system be developed across this vast landscape to help bring the Australian people together, to help bring city joys to country people.
Yeah.
Then by the second half of the 1940s, there's a debate about this newer broadcast technology, which is television. And finally, in 1956, it's decided that the sort of dual system that had been implemented for radio in Australia should also be implemented for television. So there would be a public broadcaster, and those licences go to the ABC, and there would be commercial broadcasters initially in Sydney and Melbourne, and then they also spread around Australia. So that's 1956. The ABC just manages to get itself onto air in November 1956 in time to cover the Olympic Games.
Yes, exactly. Well, apropos of moments now. That's right. Colour TV comes in 1975. Then in mid-80s, the ABC had moved into satellite broadcasting as well, enhancing its ability to distribute content nationally. The arrival of television was a massive event. It was a massive event in every country where it began. Bridget, the famous ABC logo, the Lissajou, the swirly sine wave brand, yes, which is one of the most recognisable brands in the country, wasn't there at the beginning, though, was it? Who invented it?
No, it wasn't. So it was used for a few years by the ABC in between programs, but then in 1963, the ABC comes up with the idea of conducting a competition to create a new logo for its stationery, publications, microphones, etc. And an ABC graphics designer, who we should remember, Bill Kennard, submitted a design representing a Lissajou display, and that was successful. He was presented £25 with his design. I'm not sure if he got full value for money, given how it's been used so much, adapted slightly, but really embraced since 1963, and one of the best known logos in Australia.
It is one of the best known logos in Australia. It's apparently generated when a sine wave signal is applied to the X input of an oscilloscope and another at three times the frequency of the Y input. Well, only he would know that, wouldn't he? Because after all, it's a beautiful, elegant shape. He added the letters ABC to the design, and well, the rest is history, as you say. 25 quid wouldn't have been a bad day's work back in the mid-60s.
In 1963, it would have been pretty good. Yeah, or 1965, when he, I think, was actually presented with the check.
Yes, the voices that we were hearing on ABC radio and TV broadcasts at the beginning and for many, many years were very British in style, weren't they? At that stage, the ABC was and to some degree has always looked to the BBC and that style of broadcasting, hasn't it?
It has, and there was a voice which was known as BBC English, and early ABC voices were a sort of variation on that. So they were, you know, English, near English. The now, unfortunately, late ABC historian Ken Inglis referred in his book in 1983, this is the ABC, to the theatrical rotundity of the ABC voice in the 1930s. I mean, interestingly, by the 1940s in the ABC's own magazine, the ABC Weekly, there starts to be a debate about the sort of voice or voices that could or should be heard on the ABC. And there was something of a debate about whether there was an ABC accent, an Australian accent, and whether more natural voices could or should be heard on the ABC. So you do see an increasing amount of informality as the decades pass in terms of the ABC presentation style.
That's true. Speaking of informality, Laurie Zion joins us too. Laurie started out in radio at the ABC, but of course is most famously associated with Triple J. Speaking of informality, Laurie, that's right, because were you expected to have a British accent when you started?
No. When I started, though, I wasn't actually at Triple J. I was on an intake of specialist trainees, we were called, in 1988.
Hmm.
And I think that the imagined destination for us was Radio National. But as part of that traineeship, we were put on placements where I did a placement on 3LO, now ABC Melbourne. I did a placement at Radio National and then at Triple J. But I think it was interesting when I was being interviewed, because I had two interviews actually to get this traineeship. And the whole thing about how I sounded came up. And I think that the message was, we want you to sound like how you're speaking now. We don't want you to put on voices. Yeah. And we did get some really good voice training once we were trainees, which was really about vocal delivery rather than accent. And I think at that point, by the late 80s, you know, there was still the whole continuum, the very cultivated Australian accent, if you like. Newsreaders often sounded the closest to BBC. But I think there wasn't really a lot of what you'd call the sort of ochre accents within a lot of ABC. But I think that, yeah, Triple J, it really was, essential to sound conversational all the time, as it was by then, I think, as well on what we called the metro stations, that people really did want, you know, the announcers to sound as much as possible like the listeners who were calling in. So,
that's right. Exactly. Triple J from the beginning wanted to sound different because its mission was, Laurie?
Well, its mission was to be a youth station. Yeah. And, you know, this was when it was set up, it kind of grew out of a few experimental programs in 1974 and a bit earlier. Led by Marius Webb and the late Chris Winter. And so when it was set up, it really sounded different from anything else on radio. Now, I was growing up in Melbourne and I actually could pick up, it was an AM station, I could pick up 1540 on the dial at night, with my radio in my bedroom. And because then there was still, everything was basically AM radio, the commercial stations just sounded completely different. This really, really sounded Double J as it was then. You couldn't even begin to compare it to what commercial radio sounded like.
It changed.
So
it did.
I always thought it
changed radio in the country, didn't it? It did from the beginning, because that's right. There was a staid middle of the road sort of ABC, and then all of a sudden here was this anarchic sort of sound coming in, which in terms of commercial radio, it changed the way they sounded too, didn't it?
Yeah. I think the other thing is, once commercial FM starts in Australia in the 80s, it was actually very conservative musically. So they had a lot of great kind of comedy acts on breakfast radio, and that, you know, could be fun to listen to. But one of the things that really made the J's different, although I have to say public stations like Triple R in Melbourne, Triple Z in Brisbane, were actually, sounded a little bit like the J's. But I think that when you looked at what commercial radio was playing musically, it was very middle of the road compared to, say, America, where the modern rock sort of genre of stations actually was, you know, that these were stations where you'd hear bands like The Cure and The Smiths.
Hmm.
And they really struggled to get onto commercial radio in Australia, except for kind of breakout hits. From time to time.
Sure. Laurie Zion's with us, a Triple J veteran, Bridget Griffin Foley, too, on the history of the ABC. We're talking about the life and times of the ABC in this hour, as much of it as we can get through. No story about the ABC would be complete without Charlie King. Let's cross to Darwin. Charlie King is a Gurindji man, but he's one of the ABC's best known sports broadcasters and host of Grandstand in the Northern Territory. Charlie, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Hey, nice to be on, Phil. How are you going?
Not too bad. Yeah, no, terrific to have you with us. Your career at the ABC began back in the 1990s. You've worked in TV and radio, which is itself a pretty terrific achievement as well. You remember as a kid tuning into cricket and boxing broadcasts as a kid. What were they like?
Yeah, they were good. I mean, my dad was a big ABC fan and he'd listen to the wireless, as we called it back in those days. And I remember sitting at his feet. I must have been only about 5 or 6 years old and it's dark at night. Mm-hmm. And he's listening to some boxing on the wireless. And I could see every now and then his face would light up when he took a puff from his cigarette. The glow would go on his face. And I can still remember the fight to this day. It was George Bracken fighting Aldo Prevesani for the Australian lightweight title. I don't know exactly the date, but I remember Dad being so wrapped in it. And at the end of the fight, he leaned down to me and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "He's a champion, that George Bracken. Don't worry about that." He's very proud of George Bracken. But you know what I found fabulous about it, Phil, was when they told the story on ABC radio, I could see the pictures, especially if I was sitting in the dark. They were just describing it all and I could see it. And even when the cricket was on and Alan McGilvray was doing it and they were those matches from England, I could see it. I could see the green grass. I could see, you know, birds on the pitch and the sun shining and people in their whites. And, you know, it was just fascinating. And I always loved it, enjoyed the pictures that it brought to me.
That's it, isn't it, Charlie? That's it. And you must have picked that up because you were overheard one day at a footy match doing a joke commentary. Someone said you should put that down at the ABC. The rest, as they say. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's right. And that was about 1994. I was at the footy and I used to play, loosely described as play the game.
Yeah.
And I think I'd finished the B-grade game and I was sitting on the hill with my mates watching the A-grade game, and I started mucking around calling the players, and I'd say, you know, he kicks it up the centre-half forward, great mark, Carl Dietrich. They'd say, no, you can't call him Carl Dietrich. Carl Dietrich, big blonde-headed fellas, he's small Aboriginal guy, he can't be Carl Dietrich. They'd be giving me a hard time. But that'd be Bobby Skelton or Ron Barassi or whoever. And I think an ABC broadcaster might have walked past and heard us having fun and then came up to me a bit later on and said, you should come in and put a tape down, you know. That sounded really interesting. And I thought, oh, yeah, but never, ever thought for a minute that I'd even do it, and never did until, unbelievably, I got a call from Golden West Television, rung me up one day and said, we heard you're an Indigenous football broadcaster in the Territory. We've got a big game curtain raiser to the preliminary final at the MCG in a couple of weeks' time. We want to fly you down to call the game. Phil, I'd never called a game in my life. And I was terrified to think of going to the MCG. I hadn't been to the MCG either. I was just absolutely terrified with the whole thought of it and passed it all on to a friend of mine who went down. But shows how the word can travel pretty quickly. And I wasn't even in the seat, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I was just having fun at the footy.
Missed
out on that opportunity.
Whatever your dad tapped you on the shoulder with, Charlie, you got touched with the magic wand of being able to make people see things in their mind's eye from words they hear on the radio, which is what all broadcasters are after. It was different back then, wasn't it? There were reel-to-reel tapes that you had to muck around with and all of that.
Oh, yeah. So I actually got a job. I did finally go in and put a voice down after some, you know, insistence. I went in and did it. And then they rang me up and said, come in on a Saturday and become a reporter. And so I remember going in and Dave Lennon was the presenter. And so they'd print out all these little telexes that you'd get with scores and that written on it.
Yeah.
And so you just do the boxing. And I said, okay. And I remember them just said, the very first time they crossed to me and I was sitting opposite there was Kevin Norton, who was his assistant, and Dave Lennon doing it. And Dave Lennon said on air, "And now for the first time, let's go to Charlie King, our boxing correspondent, and get all the latest that's happening in the world of boxing." Charlie. And like, I was just terrified.
Terrified, thinking, what? Stammering. What? I hardly know what's going on.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I'm stammering through a few things. But yeah, after I'd done it a few times, I got really relaxed in it. And they were terrific to me. And I must mention Peter Longman, too, who was the boss of ABC Sport at the time, was such a great supporter of mine and gave me the opportunity to become the first Indigenous broadcaster for the ABC to go to an Olympic game. So I went to two of them, one in Beijing and then one in London. And I remember having this wonderful experience. I was doing the boxing actually from London, and I was sitting there waiting for them to cross. And you know how they do it? They go in the Olympics as they used to do it before this year. They'd go round the grounds. Let's go round the grounds. We'll go to here and there, and that next person would say, "And now we'll go to so and so at somewhere else." And they came to me, and I was sitting waiting for them because I knew the order, and I was the third, fourth one. They're coming towards me, and I'm listening to it, and I'm sitting there with all the boxing happening, and I flash back to that day when I was sitting with Dad all those years earlier on his feet, listening to George Bracken and Aldo Previsani, and I just had a moment of deep emotion, thinking, gosh, I never thought that one day I would be sitting at the Olympics about to do a report on the boxing. And I just thought, wow, this is incredible business to be in.
It really is. Hey, tell me about the lawn bowls at the Manchester Commonwealth Games, Charlie.
Yes, it's a funny story. I spent quite a lot of time at Manchester at the lawn bowls at the Heaton Park, which was a fair way out of Manchester. And it rained as it did in Manchester most times, and it's even doing now. It rained for 3 days in a row, and they tried to cross to me every day, but nothing was happening. And on the third day, they listen to you downline, and they're going around the grounds, and they'd say, "Well, you know, maybe we'll go to Charlie if it's not raining." And all of a sudden, there was a streaker jumped over the fence, took all his clothes off, and just ran across the ground in front of us all. And I said, "Oh my God, there's a streaker!" And next minute, I heard them say, "Go to Charlie. 3, 2, 1, Charlie. Describe what's happening." And I thought, "Well, what am I going to say?" There's a naked man running around on the bowling green. Oh, my gosh. Over the days.
Oh, dear. Exactly. A lot of listeners, Charlie, with those word pictures that radio brings, are spread out over vast distances in the territory. The ABC means a lot to people living in regional remote parts of Australia. You'd get that in spades, wouldn't you?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, and still do too. I mean, we're, you know, a big territory, and ABC broadcasts across the Northern Territory. So if I'm down in APY lands near the South Australian border, I still pick up the ABC, or I'm up in northeast Arnhem Land, somewhere up next to, you know, somewhere like Manangreeta or maybe Nhulunbuy or somewhere, they still pick up the ABC. But why it was very useful for me is because in 2006, I started travelling, and I'd been working with the ABC for about 10 years then, and I'd been calling the football for most of those 10 years. But I'd travelled around the Northern Territory to talk to men about family violence and child abuse and those sorts of things. And me, wherever I went, they would, they'd just say, "Charlie King's coming." And so they'd all turn up and want to talk footy, which we did. We'd talk footy for a couple of hours, and then we'd sit down and start talking about those other worrying issues. So still do that even now. I was out in the APY lands about 2 months ago, and they're talking in language to people down there, Arunda people, and they'd be saying, "Football commentator," you know, just saying this whole story and pointing out that I'm the football commentator, and all turn around and have a look and talking about radio and television and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's nice to be recognised and known by people out bush, I must say.
Aboriginal people love footy. I know. One of my most treasured possessions is a carving of Buddy Franklin, Charlie, which was made by some people at Utopia who've never seen a football, well, other than a local football match, certainly never seen him play. But they knew about him. They knew about him. Yeah. So.
Can I?
Yeah, go on.
Yep. Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I wanted to tell you just a little cricket story, the commentary that we used to listen to,
yep.
And I used to try and copy them. Mm-hmm. And I still remember these are the English broadcasters on the ABC working with Alan McGilvray, but they'd be doing it from over there and he'd be in Australia, of course.
Mm.
And I used to listen to them and their commentary, and it was very different, and they were so biased, so biased. My dad would say to me, listen to these people, listen to them. They're not giving Australia a chance. And their commentary used to go something like this. And here comes Keith Miller, this great Australian fast bowler, and he bowls to Compton, and the English captain with his bat at the perpendicular has been bowled. You know, they're sort of like an afterthought that he's actually out. They were fabulous. I love thinking about them. That's now. Right.
They
painted the pictures.
That's true. Yeah, they like that. But it's like listening to a British racing commentators too, aren't they? They're very, yeah, very staid compared to Australia. Yeah, no, nice times, Charlie. Terrific, terrific career you've had too, and thanks for your time. We'll let you go, but thanks for some of those memories. It's been great.
Lovely to talk to you, Phil.
Good on you, Charlie. Bye bye, Charlie King, the ABC's legendary Northern Territory and elsewhere grandstand sports broadcaster. Back to you, Bridget and Laurie, because Bridget, sporting broadcasting, of course, is, if we're talking about things that actually unite the nation, that's a hugely important one, isn't it? The broadcast of the cricket in particular.
Yes, indeed. And that was so interesting listening to Charlie's recollections of listening as a child, mm, as well as emerging as a distinguished broadcaster in his own right. And, well, a couple of things, Phil. Going back to the 1930s, one of the real innovations of Australian radio, both the ABC but also some commercial stations, broadcast what became known as synthetic test coverage.
Yes.
So this was basically a team of announcers and producers in a studio following the results of the usually the Ashes that were coming into the studio and reenacting with sound effects, such as a pencil on a table for a run.
That's right.
Reproducing what the sound of this play would be for Australian audiences. And this innovation in the first half of the 1930s did help drive an increase in the taking up of broadcast licences, because people did need to pay to be able to listen.
That's right. Mm.
But I was also thinking, just in relation to sport and Charlie King as he was speaking, he's a youthful, I think, 70. I hope he doesn't mind me revealing this. But when he would have been listening with his father to boxing in Alice Springs in the late 1950s, there wasn't a commercial station then. So the ABC provided a sort of unique connector to sporting activities, to news events, to music, and to the outside world. It's not until 1971 that Alice Springs gets its commercial station, 8HA. So I think this sort of indicates, again, the kind of important role that the ABC plays in the lives of rural and regional Australia.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. Do you know Four Corners turns 60 next week? There have been so many iconic programs. I mean, who remembers this one, for example? Ah, yes, long before Home and Away, there was Bellbird, which was a must. I don't know, Laurie, were your parents or you into Bellbird at all?
My mum was. Blue Hills on radio, Bellbird on TV.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I must have seen some episodes of it, but I never kind of quite got it. those shows just ran for so long.
I know.
It was incredible. And, you know, I think one of the things about that time, I mean, I often sort of struggle to explain to students that there wasn't a lot of media back then, really. And if the ABC put on a series like Bellbird and it had an audience, it was going to be something people could talk about the next day that would be part of the habit of everyday life.
Yeah.
And these habits just, you know, really became ingrained into the way we understood the world around us and the way we sort of connected to.
Exactly, exactly. And of course, in your neck of the woods music, Laurie, there was this.
That as well.
Which was it? Wasn't it? It was. It was. How many music careers did that launch or pop or get going?
I didn't hear the music.
Oh, didn't you? I'm sorry, didn't you? Oh, that's
no, Phil. I couldn't hear it either. Was that Countdown?
Ah, that was Countdown. Yes. Oh, sorry. That must be some reason why you're not picking it up. No, no, Countdown exactly, which was became a massive, you know, an iconic sort of program for music, Laurie. Radio in Bridget, the Argonauts Club. Tell me about the Argonauts Club, an Australian children's radio program, which was first broadcast in, would you believe, 1933 on ABC Radio in Melbourne.
That's right. So in the 1920s, there were some really, really early children's programs and a number of children's personalities, and they tended to be called Uncle and Aunt. But by 1933, some ABC managers are discomforted by this, and this is also happening in the BBC. There's kind of a feeling that this is a little bit crass, and in the context of the ABC broadcasting landscape, there's also an awareness that uncles and aunts with popular radio programs, they could run competitions and, you know, they had money where heaven forbid that, you know, the ABC would actually send out money to winners of competitions. So there was a kind of a feeling within the ABC that it was not really a level playing field, and that perhaps the ABC should move towards something a little bit more inclined to both engender loyalty in young listeners, but also elevate and improve them. So this idea emerges of this Argonauts Club, which, as you say, is launched on 3LO in 1933. And it's based on Jason and the Argonauts. Young people could write in and be assigned a ship name and a number to be a crew member of that ship.
That's right.
The Argonauts are really a victim of their own success, because within a year or so, the ABC just can't keep even up with the demand for certificates and membership badges for these. So the idea is dropped. It's revived again during, I think, in 1941. And this becomes one of the most successful and enduring features of ABC radio. So tens of thousands of Australians, many of them notable, such as, I think, Philip Adams was one, Mike Carlton was one. There's really a sort of who's who of former Argonauts on the Australian airways, but also in Australian literature, the arts, academe, etc.
Everyone wants to hear this. Yes, indeed. That Blue Hills serial ran, would you believe, from 1949 to the end, or nearly the end, of 1976.
That's right. It's another one of these incredibly enduring Australian or ABC radio features.
Yeah.
And this really was a part of people's lives, especially rural Australians' lives, for nearly 30 years, this creation of Gwen Meredith. And in the National Library, there is a collection of the fan mail that the writer Gwen Meredith received from listeners. And amongst those many archive boxes are several folders of correspondence that just relate to the bringing to a close of this series in 1976.
Sure.
And it's an extraordinary emotional happening in the lives of many Australians.
Exactly. Speaking of emotional matters, what about when Charlie Cousins fell off the silo in Belbird? Gee, Sue says, I love Belbird. I never forget when Charlie Cousins fell off the silo. Pamela in Campbell says, my family watched Belbird every night. And when in my year 12 HSC, we studied The Woodlanders by Thomas Hardy, and our English lit teacher got very cross as we could identify a character in Belbird who was very similar to a character in The Woodlanders. Ah, oh, dear. That's right. Deborah from The Grove says, yes, Joe Turner and Charlie Cousins falling off the wheat silo, Belbird as a child, and before or after GTK, and that was groovy. Yeah, that was, you would, Laurie, remember GTK for sure, wouldn't you?
Only very vaguely. Yeah. I don't think I can't remember what years GTK ran through, but I didn't really watch anything before Countdown.
It was only about 10 minutes long. I remember seeing Jimi Hendrix on it once and I thought, gee, there's another world out there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Tell me about the Hot 100, Laurie, which you had a big influence on.
So what happened was that when I was doing a kind of placement for 3 months at Triple J, when it was still a Sydney-only station, JJJ then, there was Rolling Stone ran a critics poll of the 100 greatest songs of the rock era. And this was late 80s, but it was full of songs from the 60s. Satisfaction, I think, was number one. And Like a Rolling Stone was in there. And it actually was you know, like a kind of canonized selection of great songs at a time when there was a kind of move for pop music to be sort of recognized as an art form. But I read an article in the Village Voice, which is a magazine. It was a New York sort of street paper that we managed to get air freighted into the library at the J's. And a journalist called Barry Walters sort of took on this whole concept of greatness with music, because for pop music, he said, the whole point is it's what you enjoy. It's not really whether it's great enduring culture.
Mm.
And he did a list of his own favourite tracks, which I think had Dancing Queen at number two and a disco song called Heaven at number one. And I thought it'd be really interesting to see, you know, has Triple J ever done anything like that at all? I asked around and the answer was no. And I thought it'd be really interesting to give something like that a go. And I went to the station manager, Andy Neal, who had just started there, and he'd been at Triple Z in Brisbane, where he had, as it happened, done a kind of Hot 100, had done a listener poll there over a number of years. And he said, well, you know, I'm going to just say yes to your idea right now because I was looking to do something similar. And so we kind of got to work. He said, you know, you can have an exercise book to tabulate the votes. And we put out a call for people just to send us their lists by mail, by snail mail,
right,
of their 10 favourite songs of all time. And, you know, the first few days, 20 or 30 come in, and then it really starts to build up. People are sending in artistic entries.
Well, this is the people are writing in, but they're writing letters, of course. That's right.
Writing long letters.
No one's sending text messages, no.
Well, there was no text messages back then. I don't even think the fax machine was properly revved up back then. We had one computer in the station. And the concept sort of really became something that became part of every radio shift. We'd go through, whoever is announcing or presenting would go through an entry that had come in from a listener. And I think, you know, my role was to kind of go on and talk to people who were struggling to decide which was, you know, which was their ninth or 10th song that was going to be in the list. So this idea that, it, you know, the idea was, write down the songs that mean a lot to you now, that are your favorite songs now. And so that's how it started. But there was a fear that the list would end up not really representing what the station imagined its listeners were listening to, and that, you know, Stairway to Heaven would be number one, I think, was one of the big anxieties. And I think it was number 20. It wasn't number one. But the thing about it was actually that no one really knew what was going to happen. And there was a genuine sort of sense of suspense at the station as to what would this list actually look like.
Yeah.
And so when there were a couple of people who guessed that the number one song would be the Joy Division classic Love Will Tear Us Apart, which at that time was a song that was about 10 years old.
Mm.
And there are a lot of Australian bands in the list, not as many as you find in the last 20 years in the annual listener poll, but, you know, there were four tracks from Hunters and Collectors. There was Midnight Oil, the Go-Betweens, the Triffids. And so it was a list that actually was quite unlike anything anyone would have really sat down and imagined. And it was counted down as an event in March the 5th, 1989. So back then it wasn't linked to Australia Day. The whole idea was meant to be just a one-off.
Yeah.
I was so relieved when we got through that, and I thought, oh, okay, that was good. And then pretty quickly, station management said, well, that was good. We should do it every year. And so
it has. It's run every year except in 1991, but it's run every year since.
So the difference was that for the first three of them, what we were doing was the same concept: write down a list of your 10 favourite songs of all time, and we're getting fairly similar results. And then it was decided, give it a rest and come back with trying to do it as an annual poll of songs of the year.
Hmm.
And that's when, I mean, I was no longer directly working on it then, but I think that's when the Hottest 100 that we know now took the form that is familiar and that's really endured for far longer than anyone would have imagined, exactly. Especially me.
Exactly. Yes, I know. This was back in the day, Bridget, of course, when, you know, the media was more important in a way. That, of course, these days there are so many things to listen to and so many ways to listen to it as well. And online has become, you know, such a massive thing. But back then, programs which people listened to, they listened to in very large numbers. And, you know, current affairs programs in particular, and the ABC's role in current affairs has been huge. I mean, there was this show.
Good evening. I'm Bill Peach, and the program is This Day Tonight. We're up against some pretty stiff competition, like The Man from Uncle, which I guess makes me The Man from Auntie. But apart from a cold, which Huey has kindly sent down to me this night, we've had some congratulatory telegrams. Congratulatory. And I'll just give you a selection of these. One from Arthur Ryler. My teenage daughter and I are watching with interest. Please don't disappoint us. We'll try. From Miracle Margarine, we'll buy the whole 30 minutes. And one from Dr. Darling, chairman of the ABC. You have nothing to fear but fear itself.
Yeah, what a program that was, Bridget.
Indeed.
What a program that
launched in 1967. And what we've just heard there from Bill Peach, I think his voice says something about the evolution of the presenter's voice at the ABC that, you know, we were talking about a while ago now.
Mm.
Yes. It was a very naturalistic voice. And I have a particular memory of that because I was, I think, in grade two or three when that started. And I remember it wasn't something that my parents thought I should watch because I was meant to be in bed. I think it was on at 7:30. And they actually shifted my bedtime so I could watch that every night. This is how I connected to my interest in news and current affairs. And it was such a big influence on my childhood. And Bill Peach, he had a naturalistic voice compared to other presenters at the ABC at the time. And that it also, I think, had the best theme of any news program ever. So it was a real landmark program.
It was too. Linus has given us a call. Hi, Linus.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
Not bad. Hi. This your story of your wife's grandmother. So this is a good one.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they were in a retirement place called Kenilworth in Barrel for many years. Lovely person Gwen was. They used to play bridge together.
Oh, yeah. This is Gwen Meredith we're talking about, who wrote Blue Hills.
Gwen Meredith, yeah. Yes. And Lola, who was my my wife's grandmother, said she was just gorgeous and you wouldn't have known who she was. And, just a wonderful story.
Fantastic. It is a wonderful story. The wonderful stories that she wrote too. Thanks, Linus. Yeah, that's a fantastic memory. Knitting the country together. The ABC has always been, I think, a key part of that, Bridget, hasn't it? This notion of bringing us together in lots of different ways. The ABC has been hugely important in city to country, country to city, all of those links that we like to think. You know, people in the city who've never been to the bush think they're part of the bush, and in part because ABC radio and television have brought them together.
That's right. And when the ABC is launched in 1932, there are hardly any national media outlets. The Bulletin was probably the most significant national outlet at the time. In 1933 comes the Australian Women's Weekly, but it's not until the late 1950s that Australia gets national daily newspapers in the form of the Australian Financial Review and then the Australian in 1964. So the ABC does play a really early and quite unique role in bringing Australia together. Both at times of major political events, at times of, assassinations, but also through a range of sort of regular programs like the Country Hour that was launched in 1945, and Australia All Over, of course, with Macca. That
yes, exactly.
Yes,
dear Macca. That's right.
Summarise what Australia All Over is.
Yes, dear Macca. All right. Charles in Warrnambool says, as a child of the 50s, growing up on a farm, our day's work was governed by having to be back at the house for the Country Hour. Yes, exactly. Laurie, were you ever a Mr. Squiggle fan? He was a pretty cool guy, the man from the moon, Laurie.
It was, it was high tech for its time,
yeah,
I guess. I think it was such a simple concept, and every day I watched it, I was just glued to it. It was another really long running.
A bloke from the moon who could do drawings backwards.
It was great. And a good theme tune as well.
Yeah. Of course, it's Play School, isn't it? If you think about children's TV, Bridget, I suppose, which has been so important and still running, of course. It's hard to overemphasise the importance of that program, is it?
That's right. It's launched in 1966. It's based on a British program, but it has become the longest running children's television program in Australia, and I think perhaps the second longest running in the world.
Yeah.
And there has been such a long tradition of important and engaging children's shows like Mr. Squiggle, like Play School, like the earlier Kindergarten of the Air and the Argonauts that were on radio. And then, of course, we have Bananas in Pyjamas and Bluey, one of the great international success stories of the ABC.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly, exactly.
And right. The Magic Circle Club, you left that one out, Bridget.
You're quite right, Laurie.
Oh, dear.
A really important program.
The ABC turns 90 next year. Laurie, do you think there's, I mean, this huge, the media has disaggregated itself hugely. I mean, the ABC faces arguments about its existence all the time. Where do you think it's the role of national broadcasters is going to be?
Well, funnily enough, I think while we've been talking about how it's brought the nation together, I also think it's got an increasingly critical role in providing local coverage, because what we've seen, over the last 10 years due to digital disruption is the closure or, reduction in a lot of regional media in particular, and urban media as well. But there are areas which are really struggling to get, you know, the kind of daily newspaper daily commercial TV programs that you know, were part and parcel of the last 20 or 30 years. So the ABC's role in regions is only going to get more important over time.
I think that's right, actually. People talk about the role of national broadcasters, but it's really, in a sense, the role of the ABC as a local broadcaster, which is going to be so important. Terrific to have both of your time tonight. Laurie Zion, former producer and presenter on Triple J from La Trobe University. Thanks, Laurie.
Thanks so much.
And Bridget Griffin-Foley from Macquarie University too, who's written many books on the history of the media and so on. Bridget, terrific to talk again.
Thanks, Phil. It's been fun.
Good on you. Bridget Griffin-Foley there with us as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.